Why did everybody get so quiet? Can we just keep talking? Maybe that'll make me feel less nervous. I only exposed this part of my life once before in public at the Rio Church in, on Airways. I think this was about 3 weeks ago. Can everybody hear me? Because it's kind of strange having something on your ears. I asked John for some duct tape in case it comes off, but he refused. I believe that for the most part, we've all spoken about our life in one way or another, about our experiences. Some of them are good, some of them are bad, and some of them are just downright embarrassing. This is not embarrassing. This is a good part of my life. Although throughout my testimony, you may think, well, how, what's good about that? The end, I promise you, is good. The reason I have this laptop in front of me is to hide myself. Now, it's to use as a, I guess, a little teleprompter, a little, I don't like using paper. The first time I gave the testimony, the letters were about this size, so it was very, very hard. Now they're about this size, and it really feels great. First of all, this is one of the most warmest churches I've ever been to. When you walk in, you feel the love, don't you? Does everybody, I see a lot of nodding heads, and everybody agrees. Everybody's face is warm, everybody's face is just, there's a wisdom, there's a warmth, there's a love there, and I appreciate that. It's in Airways, it's here. What do you call this, the Red Road? Okay. Or Donovan? West Side, okay. But anyways, I really like that. Why is this part of my life so hard to speak of? The reason being, it's what brought me to my knees. And usually what brings you to your knees, you don't want to speak of ever again. It's not because you did something wrong. In some cases, maybe it is. In this case, it's not. I don't feel that it's my fault. Of course, I hope today that somebody benefits from this testimony. I'm going to put my water down because I'm afraid this thing's just going to slam down here. In 1994, I was married to my former wife. We had a beautiful son a year later. My son Joey was born in November the 1st, 1995. His name is Joey. And to me, Joey was perfect in every way you could imagine. He possessed a special gentleness in his face, much like what I see here in everybody's face. They're gentle, loving, warm, kind. And he had a strong sense of curiosity for everything that surrounded him. He loved looking at things and objects and people. His interaction was different, though. During the first 10 months of age, he was pretty much a normal baby. He ate, he wore diapers, he cried when he was hungry, he giggled a lot, and life was perfect. At 10 months of age, Joey was diagnosed with a seizure disorder. They couldn't explain why. Maybe it was 28-hour labor. I'm not a physician, so I don't know what causes these things. So you become very inquisitive, very curious as to that big question, why? Why is this occurring? What did we do? Did we not take enough prenatal vitamins? I think I even took a few. Joey was diagnosed with having this disorder seizure possibly about 10 to 12 months. After that time, he was given a ton of medication. Some of them are called phenobarbital, lorazepam, valproic acid, diazepam, Valium, and Depakote. That's just about, I would say, about a third of the medications. As his condition worsened, the number of medications given were increased, and so was the dosage. As a result, Joey slept 90% of the day. Nevertheless, he averaged a total of 20 to 35 short seizures per day, most of which occurred at night. That's a lot of seizures when you're trying to sleep and still hold a job from 9 to 5. But we did it, and life was good. We kept going. At 14 months, Joey began having difficulties with swallowing his food. At first, he would drink out of a bottle just like any normal baby, and he loved to eat. Eventually, he couldn't swallow foods or liquids. He would choke on them. He would, what would you call that? Reflux. He had like an acid reflux condition. So he began aspirating the food into his lungs, which caused a lot of lung conditions or lung difficulties. When you put liquid in the lungs or food, I imagine that's not a good thing. That's not what the lungs were meant for. Do the results of a test that he took recently after that called the barium swallow test, where they make him, I guess, swallow some kind of a charcoal-y fluid to see and track with some machine where this food was going. Yes, it was going into the lungs. So, in fact, he needed a procedure called funduplication. And I believe that's still the way it's pronounced. Funduplication is a procedure that was supposed to ensure that Joey would not aspirate food into his lungs or have any kind of reflux thereafter. Funduplication didn't work, and Joey was then scheduled to have a gastrostomy tube installed in his abdomen, usually known as a G-tube. And that G-tube is used to feed your baby via a bolus, or what they call it many things, but it's kind of like a syringe, and you just pour the liquefied food into a tube, and this tube is attached to a Mickey button on his abdomen. The fact that it's called a Mickey button didn't make it any easier. It just was cute, I guess, but it's still kind of strange. You have to watch for infections. You want to make sure he doesn't pull it out. You want to make sure you don't pull it out. So it was a strange time that he was being fed. And he wasn't aspirating as much as he used to. As time went by, Joey began displaying attributes that were later diagnosed as developmental delays. They called it that because he could no longer reach for something and grab something, or you couldn't hand him a toy and he would take interest in it, he would just look at it. And he couldn't walk naturally. This was before the age that he even began to learn. He actually crawled probably twice before that. So yes, it was a developmental delay. Eventually, he could not walk. He began to lose most of his basic motor skills. He could still blink his eyes, yawn, cough, cry. He couldn't speak or articulate his needs. So basically, he began communicating with his eyes, I believe. Some of us, in fact, all of us do in one way or another. When we're angry, our eyes do something. When we're happy, the eyes do something else. When we're confused, they make a different expression. Well, he was good at this. And I always knew when he was in need, when he was happy, sad, curious, it was in the eyes. Soon after that, he was unable to track. By that, I mean he couldn't look you straight in the eye. He was up here, looking around. The effects of the medications that I described earlier make you very drowsy, very dizzy, and it's like being on Benadryl, at least for me. I can't have Benadryl because it just wipes me out. So imagine living life like that. It's not easy to stay awake. And I feel that maybe that's the reason why he couldn't track, he couldn't look me in the eye. I don't think it was a voluntary thing. I bought Joey a tricycle at the fourth month of gestation. He was 4 months, he had his tricycle. He wasn't even born yet. I don't have it anymore. So needless to say, those were not the first set of wheels he ever got. It wasn't a tricycle. It was a custom-made wheelchair with all sorts of complicated things, levers, Velcro, pillows, adjusters, pins, bolts, nuts, screws. And it looked like a robot. It looked like just a bunch of metal put together. It didn't make sense. didn't make sense until we put him on it. Then we realized that's what's supporting his body to remain in a particular shape that wouldn't maybe deform his back from constant positioning. It was adjustable, it was good. Life went on and we went on. By this time, Joey had a pediatrician, an endocrinologist, a neurologist, a gastrologist, a physical and occupational therapist, and a dietitian. Most of us just have a mechanic, right? He had a lot of people in his medical team. They were very friendly, very professional, very kind-hearted people, most of which were at Providence and Sierra Medical. It wasn't his favorite hospital. He didn't have really a choice in the matter. It was ours. Sierra Medical was our favorite hospital because he had his own suite, it seemed, because every time we'd go there, it was the same room. And we were there so often that maybe we didn't give anyone else a chance to get in. It was nice. It had a little kitchenette, had a little living room. So yeah, it felt like home. At 14 months, Joey was being admitted to the hospital almost every 2 to 3 months due to severe fevers and upper respiratory conditions. They called it they had different names for it. We call it the common cold. They call it the rhinovirus, I believe. That's when it becomes more like a pneumonia, if I'm not mistaken. Only this time, the seizures started to worsen. They became a lot more intense. When a seizure becomes more intense, it's called a grand mal seizure, and it'll last up to 5 minutes or longer. His were lasting at least, they started with 3 minutes before. Now they were up to 8. And he was getting about 48 to 52 per day. I used to count them. I used to write it down. I used to tabulate all of that. I felt that maybe if I did that, I could help the physicians come to an answer or a cure. Joey's mother, she was great with Joey. She loved him a lot. However, by the time Joey was around 2 years of age, she decided to leave the house, which was very difficult for Joey. And it was very difficult on the marriage. She decided to leave home in search of a new reality. And as a result, I then became a single dad. Joey and I were fortunate at that time, though, to find a nursing provider that cared for Joey at home while I went to work. I was still able to put in my 8 hours, still able to get there on time, and I was in time for dinner. Life was good. I couldn't wait to get home, and I really, really enjoyed caring for him. There was nothing else I could possibly think or imagine myself doing. This was, when we go to work, we can't wait to get home. There's always a reason. Some of us don't want to go home, and there's always a reason. For the most part, I'm sure here everyone does want to go home. But this was different. This was a joy unimaginable. You're driving down the highway and you have a smile ear to ear because you know where you're going. You know what you're going to see. You're going to see your young boy turn around in the crib and look at you. Or at least turn around and look in that direction. And he did, every day. It's all I ever wanted. Joey found an infinite joy in very simple things. One thing I remember he really enjoyed was music. He enjoyed, New Age music. I know that sounds kind of cheesy, but for a child especially. But he liked Yanni, and he liked peaceful sounds. Enya. I know these names are a little strange to some, but so I got to like it as well, and one of his nurses had recommended I play that, and it worked. How did he react? Well, he didn't clap, he didn't sing, he didn't do much of anything except he would stretch. And that was his way of saying, I like this. He would stretch his feet, stretch his body. He would look around. But still, he wouldn't look me in the eye, or any of us for that matter. At night, Joey and I used to sit in his bed, and I'd get in the bed with him. He had a hospital bed also, apart from the wheelchair. In fact, by then, he had two wheelchairs for two different purposes. And he had a shower chair, too, so we had a lot of these funny-looking gizmos. But at night, I got in the hospital chair, and I'd raise it up a little, and we'd sit together, and we'd look up, or we'd lay down and look up at the ceiling. And it was dreamy. It was beautiful because there was these little stars that we had glued up there. You know, those little glow-in-the-dark stars, they're plastic, and they really do work. And we had a black light, and we had all kinds of little laser stuff going on. It was great. It was our world. It was special. And just to see him gazing up there was magical. He had the planets. He had the stars. We didn't ever named them. I don't think we ever did that. But we did that every single night. Then it was time for medication, and then it was time for bed. Because that naturally, within about, I'd say, 2 or 3 minutes, would knock him out. Then I got some sleep. Then he would have a seizure, and I'd wake up and go attend him. It only took a few minutes, and then I went back to bed. And that was the norm. Get up, go make sure he's still okay. Why should I? Why did I? Rather, I wanted to make sure he was okay after the seizure, because when you have a seizure, sometimes you're not breathing right. You're not breathing as deeply, or you start breathing shallow, and you just want to make sure he's okay. So you go back to bed, but kind of like those people that sleep with one eye closed. Well, I did that with one ear open. Just listening to his breath, and it was a magical sound to that breath. It was refreshing. It was full of life. To hear him sigh, which he did beautifully. I mean, he would just, I think the sigh is a beautiful thing. To some people, the sigh means boredom. To me, it meant life. It meant, okay, I'm over the seizure. I'm okay. I can go on. I can sleep. So it was peaceful and life was good. Although Joey wasn't able to speak at all, he couldn't articulate words, he couldn't learn them, we tried. He once said day, so I assumed he was trying to say daddy, and I think I was just flattering myself, but he said day very well, for some reason. And he said it all day long sometimes. Even though he wasn't able to speak, this young man, he taught me many things. He gave me the opportunity to explore my spirit. He gave me the opportunity to explore my spirit deeper than I ever imagined possible. He drove me in ways that I could never possibly do on my own. Joey had this ability to teach people, not just me. He had an ability to make relationships without a word, without a single word. Everyone in the hospital knew him by name. Nurses loved him, doctors loved him. Everybody loved him. He was popular. Didn't care about dad. They wanted to see how Joey was doing and greet him. And they had clothes for him. We didn't need clothes. He had clothes, but they had purchased clothing for him so that when he would go back to the hospital, they could surprise him with a Bert and Ernie shirt or something cute. So it was very, very nice, very kind people. Joey taught me how precious life is. He taught me how not to take things for granted. But one thing that still lasts, he taught me about forgetting about my own needs, my own desires, my own dreams. That never mattered anymore. My dream was Joey. That was for him to be well, for him to be comfortable. That was my dream. That was the reason for getting up. That was the reason for coming home. On October of 1999, as usual, he was rushed again to Sierra Medical Hospital via ambulance. For the same reason, he had a severe fever and symptoms of upper respiratory infection, which had been ongoing for a couple of weeks, only they got a lot worse, and it was affecting his oxygen saturation. He had his little O2 meter on his finger at home, too, so we could monitor that. If it went too far or too shallow, it was a reason for attention, naturally. So I was at work at that time when they called me. When I showed up to ICU, I couldn't believe what I saw. They hadn't cleaned him up, and there was, I'm sorry this is a little graphic, but there's blood everywhere. Like, he had coughed up blood, and there was blood coming out of his nose. So naturally, as a father, when you see this, you become a little, not uncomfortable, you just downright angry, because what is the hospital doing here? Or why is he like that? Well, I was wrong in assuming that they were wrong. They were trying their best to keep this young man stable, keep him alive. So I cleaned him up. Didn't help much, because every time he coughed, it was just very painful to see. And I had a feeling something was going on, and sure enough, they put him on life support, I believe, the same night. I stopped working. I didn't leave my job. I took all my vacation pay for 3 months. We stayed at Sierra Medical. When they took him to Providence, and then from there, they took him to Sierra Medical in a nice, bright, red ambulance, which I think he would have liked had he seen it from the outside. Unfortunately for him, he was looking at it from the inside, which is a different thing altogether. You don't think of those things then. Pediatric ICU is a very, very scary place to be. You see other parents, but you can't relate to them. You really don't. You close up. You don't talk. You simply hide under the bed, I guess, and sleep there. There's nothing really to socialize about. It's not really a place for tea and crumpets. It's not a social network. It's a hell, is what it is. I'm sorry for the expression. During October, November, and December, Joey never displayed any favorable changes in his health. He simply got worse. Most nights he would code blue. If any of you have been in a hospital or in an emergency room, code blue means everybody needs to get over there and do what they do. And the staff did it very well. There was a lot of staff, a lot of people writing things down, people pushing buttons, people moving them around, people placing things in his IV, and it was very confusing. You're not sure what's going on. Even though it happened over and over and over again, you don't get used to that. You're on the sidelines, you're back here, you're watching this, and you're dreading the silence. It never happened. He would code and he would come back. He would bounce right back. During this time, he was already on life support, but for some reason, the reason they would do this code blue, is to bag additional oxygen into his lungs. Even though the respirator was providing all it could do as a machine, it needed the human element to, I guess, add more oxygen. They called it a bagging. They put a bag over his mouth, and there's a mouthpiece, and they would, or over his face, rather. And luckily it worked. This was always surreal and very debilitating. We spent Thanksgiving, Christmas, and New Year's at Sierra Medical Center, which was okay. There was people wearing costumes, there's people bringing gifts. Family was there. At least we were all together, and there was always hope. On New Year's Eve, the funny thing happened. The IT technicians were running around frantically from one room to another, testing their... They had a laptop, and they would plug into the respirators, and they'd plug into all these machines, plug into the wall, making sure that everything was going well. The reason they did this was because Y2K was, I guess, at that time destined to... what was it? Was that the end of the world? It was supposed to happen then, but it didn't. It was scary. And we laugh about it now, and I laugh about it now, but when you have a son on life support that is being, I guess, controlled by a computer system, you take it very seriously. And I could still smile and laugh about that, but back then I took it very seriously, and I was scared too. I asked a lot of questions. I asked, when you leave, what do I do? What button do I push, or who do I call when that respirator goes down? So yeah, I was concerned about everything, about his breathing, about terrorism, about duct tape on the windows. Everything came to mind. It's pretty scary. On January the 2nd, the medical team required, and I don't know if the date's correct, but around January the 2nd, the doctors and the medical team required that I attend daily meetings, and they were like a little powwow to discuss my plans for, my future plans for Joey. This was done considering that he wasn't getting any better. I disliked those meetings a lot. Who wants to speak of the possibility of losing a child? Nevertheless, I went along with it, and I insisted that he would get better, and we were still there. On January the 7th, year 2000, Joey's doctor actually walked into ICU with his x-rays, proudly. He held him up to the machine or the light on the wall, turned on the light. He practically had he had this pep about him, this joy. When he looked at the lungs, and I don't know what that means. I see lungs, I see x-rays. I see two colors, black and white. He explained that Joey's lungs were then cleared completely. Completely clear. I was thinking, it's about time. Been here for 3 months. Dr. Canales, he said, Joey's going to be going home in a couple days. We're going to keep him here for observation. So they began to, I don't know what the correct term is, to take the intubation out. And they did. He ordered the removal of the respirator. I was thrilled. I was the happiest man in the world once again. I wasn't scared. If Y2K wants to happen late, it's okay. It's not going to affect me or my son. So I started calling everybody, and later that afternoon, Joey was awakened from the induced coma. When you go on to life support, you're basically in a coma. So they woke him up, and it took a while. But when he woke up, boy, was he awake. He didn't just move around slowly after he was awake. He opened one eye first, and then when he started looking around, he opened the other, keeps looking around, looks at shapes and more colors and things and angles, something that he normally did, just not that. He wasn't that interested before. I guess maybe because the environment was new. This wasn't the bedroom with the stars on the ceiling. This was another place. Then Joey turns around and he looks straight at me, straight into my eyes. I freaked out. I didn't know whether to be happy or scared. I freaked out. It was a very personal thing. It was strange. This is my son looking at me in the eye. I didn't have that pleasure. Keep in mind, he didn't look me in the eye for about 3.5 years, and he was 4. So the effect was grand, to say the least. Anyways, he kept smiling and staring some more and looking at me right in the eye. And he would look around again, and then he'd look me in the eye, and he'd look at something else, and he'd look me in the eye, and he just had this funny little pattern that he followed. But what really stuck to me is it wasn't the fact that he was looking at angles or colors or shapes or even the fact that he was looking at me in the eye. What really stuck was that he looked at me like he wanted to tell me something. He had this look in his eye like, everything's okay. There's nothing to worry about anymore. Now, how did he do that? He can't speak a word except day. It was very calming. It was like when your father looks at you. And there's a lot of fathers here, and I've seen how they look at their children, and it's beautiful. It's calming. It reminds me of my son. It's full of love. It was calm. It's peaceful. And if he could say, Dad, everything's going to be fine, he would have. He did. I had never, ever seen my son so happy, so eager to get out of bed and go home. Of course, he can't do it on his own because he can't walk. So he would need a chair. We weren't allowed to put him in his chair yet because they had to do some other things to him. I guess therapies or something, because he had been in that position for so long that you don't want to take the body and I guess just place him on a chair and maybe he would pull a muscle or something. So maybe they wanted to warm his body up first and get him on the chair, but it was a little early for that. It's the best day of my life. It seemed to be the best day of his. Joey didn't have a single seizure. Keep in mind, he used to have 30 to 52 seizures a day. Some were small, some were just a little bit of jerking, and some were downright violent. He didn't have a single one all day. And the day went on, and we watched TV. We watched soap operas, which we never did. The day went on, we fell asleep. We fell asleep with smiles on our face. He was smiling and I was smiling. At least we felt that way. I did. At 1 a.m. the following morning, Joey's lungs filled with fluid again, in spite of what the doctor had said. I didn't realize it could happen so quickly. And he coded blue 4 times that night, between 1 a.m. and 11:30 a.m. the next day. Naturally, he was placed back on life support. They put the respirator back on. They were talking about other options, such as what I remember being called ECMO, E-C-M-O, or something like that, where they take the blood and they oxygenate it and they put it back in. Kind of like a dialysis for the lungs, I guess. We discussed it once. I never really pursued that. He wasn't saturating very well. By saturating, meaning he wasn't absorbing oxygen very well. He was down to 16%. So even with the respirator, it wasn't helping. So they began to code blue and do the airbag push, if you will, that's what I call it. I could see the frustration in the eyes and the faces of the people in the hospital. They looked drained. And I was drained. Everybody was spent. And people started to leave, which didn't make sense. This was different. I'd been through so many of these, and this was different. Why are people leaving? Dr. Canales looks back at me. And very gently he said, I'm sorry. We've lost him. We've lost Joey. And of course, time stood still. Very still. You can't hear. You can't. Your perception changes. Your senses change. You don't know where you are or what you're doing there and why this is happening. It's not something I expected. I expected to go home, cruise around in a wheelchair, push Joey all over the house, play and look at the stars, do something fun. This is very disappointing. This was the day that Joey went home. This was the day that Joey died. I held Joey at that moment so tight and told him it was okay to go. It was okay to go back. Wherever you've been, Joey, it's okay to go back, I would tell him. I spent at least 15, 20 minutes with him alone. Some family members would go in and out. Mom would go in and out. I insisted on staying. Combed his hair, and I put his clothes on. In a hospital, he had, I guess, the gown, whatever, diaper. I put his clothes on, as if we were going home. Why did I do that? I don't know. I think the hospital staff maybe understood, maybe not, but I knew why. It wasn't that I was going to pick him up and take him home. Naturally, I knew better. But I just had to do that. After that, the hospital takes over, and you make arrangements with the person that picks him up and takes him to the funeral home. So I did that. That wasn't too bad. It was quick. It's just, it gets worse when you see them take him, I guess. I wasn't supposed to see that, I don't think. So I began getting very, what should we call it, angry, confused, hurt. Everything came into play at once. And I had a word with God. I needed to know. I spoke to God that day like I had never done before. We all have prayed. I had prayed. This was not a prayer. No. This was a demand. And I demanded to know. I demanded to know if God existed. I wasn't very nice about it either. Respectful, but demanding. I simply wanted to know if my son would not be in a dark place, alone. Because to me, he was still alive. I couldn't accept that he was gone. It felt like I was leaving him at a daycare. And you take a look around and, okay, I think it's suitable. I think I'll leave him here. That's what was going through my mind. My heart. And God, he didn't answer me. Maybe it was my approach. And there was this silence. There was this horrible silence. This the room was gray. Everything was bland. Everything was horribly dark and quiet. People would speak and you see their lips moving and you don't know what they're saying. In fact, I didn't really care. I had no interest in what they had to say. I had no interest in them saying, oh, he's in a better place. I was in disbelief. I was in a stage of concern. in efforts to cope with what had happened, I tried to remember how great Joey was doing the day before. I tried to hold on to that day, that day that he woke up and he looked me square in the eyes and he was smiling and looking at me like I should be the one to calm down and be okay. And it helped. It helped when I saw his smile and his wide, eager eyes and warm and comforting expression. It was then that I knew for sure that God existed. I think that's what revealed it to me, is remembering the smile, remembering the eyes, remembering that he looked like a kid that wanted to go back outside and play. He did. He went back outside and he's played. So God did, in fact, answer my question even before I asked. He placed the answer right before me, but I must have forgotten. After this, I felt a little more comfortable knowing that I could review or relive that experience and comfort myself with the memory. 4 months passed, and sooner than later, I began to doubt. Anger set in after the funeral and after everything was over. I doubted God. I doubted that this was a sign strong enough for me to believe. Was this enough? It wasn't at that time. Anger set in, depression was on its way, really fast. Never saw anybody about that. I stopped going to church. I closed in. I did what I had to. I went to work. Still nothing mattered. I only went to work so I could stay alive. Pay the bills, I guess. Didn't iron my clothes. Hard to keep a job like that. But I did. Nothing seemed to matter. Nothing was enjoyable. Life just goes on without you. You're suddenly separate from everybody. You isolate yourself. You just do. On October the 10th, year 2000, I met Marianne, my wife. She's sitting right over here. During a fire evacuation at the office building where we both worked, she's carrying a tiny little box at the end of her fingertips, kind of like this. Now, who does that in a fire? In a fire escape stairwell full of people. And I'm watching this from behind, and I'm thinking, oh, this girl's going to get us in trouble. Because if that box drops, everyone's going to panic. If one person falls, that's the person that's going to get trampled on. So, no, I wasn't flirting. I was simply offering to carry her box. And she accepted. She said, thank you very much. And she handed it over like this. She didn't turn back. We reached the bottom floor of the building, the lobby, and I gave her box. And she smiled, like she's doing now, only with more teeth. Just she's not missing any teeth. I mean, she was just... She was smiling ear to ear like she was happy or something. And I was miserable. I don't think she knew that until she saw the lack of response. She says, thank you, you're very kind. I gave her box, and I had no expression. Zero. I was like a block of concrete. I simply looked at her and shrugged like, whatever, and walked away. Yeah, that was rude, I think. When somebody says thank you, you're supposed to say, anybody, you're welcome, right? And I didn't. I simply walked away from something very special. And life went on. A few months later, Marion asked one of her co-workers, and this she told me later, "I wonder who that man was. You know, the man who carried my box for me during the evacuation?" And one of her co-workers said, "Oh, that's just Joe. I've known him since the sixth grade." And life has never been the same since. Marion and I were married 1 year later, October the 27th. Did I get that right? 27th? I will survive today. And she's never stopped giving me nothing but joy, nothing but love, nothing but smiles, nothing but the reminder of what I saw that day. Sometimes I'll do funny things or silly things just to bring it out again. Sometimes she just does it. First thing in the morning, she's smiling, she jumps out of bed, I roll out of bed, I fall on the ground, and I climb into the restroom. She jumps. You could almost hear the mattress just springing. She's got lots of life. And now, here we are, in the most awesome and loving church that we've ever known. With very warm faces, lots of smiles everywhere. No pain. I'm sure we all have something, but it seems like none of you are carrying that with you. None of them are exerting that. Because you too saw the smile somewhere. You too are reminded every week, every day, when you see your children, that there is a God. We really love everyone here at The Real. Thank you for listening to my testimony and how God brought me to my knees. I don't have scars to show you, but this is it. This is what happened. Thank you.